on climate, cooperation is the only way to get this job done.
U.S. and China surprise climate summit with joint declaration. It's Friday, November 12th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. You can also find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, former Australian Prime Minister criticizes Canberra's China policy. COVID vaccine available for U.S. kids. Fake vaccination card scams. Global recognition for U.S. public school teacher and four astronauts on their way to International Space Station. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United States and China surprised the COP26 climate summit with a joint declaration to develop long-term strategies to try to limit global warming below 2 degrees Celsius over the next decade. It comes as delegates enter the final hours of negotiation on a deal to slow global warming. Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA.
China and the United States are the world's two biggest polluters, and their future actions critical in the fight against climate change. So the two countries' joint declaration was welcomed at the COP26 summit Wednesday. U.S. climate envoy John Kerry.
The United States and China have no shortage of differences, but on climate, cooperation is the only way to get this job done. This is not a discretionary thing, frankly. This is science. It's math and physics that dictate the road that we have to travel.
China's chief climate negotiator, Xie Zhenhua, echoed John Kerry's sentiments.
In the area of climate change, there is more agreement between China and the U.S. than divergence, making it an area with huge potential for our cooperation.
Among the pledges were cooperation on controlling methane emissions, tackling illegal deforestation, enhancing renewable energy generation, and speeding up financial support for poorer nations. But the declaration did not include specific dates or targets. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres tweeted after the declaration, "Tackling the climate crisis requires international collaboration and solidarity, and this is an important step in the right direction. It has given new momentum to the negotiations as delegates try to agree on a final summit text by Friday, detailing how countries will limit global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the target set in Paris in 2015. Summit host Boris Johnson urged delegates to grasp the opportunity.
We're now finding things are tough, but that doesn't mean it's impossible. It doesn't mean that we can't keep 1.5 alive.
Delegates are also negotiating how much richer nations should pay developing countries to mitigate the effects of climate change and decarbonize their economies, a pledge first made in 2009. Again, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
And it's very frustrating to see countries that have spent 6 years conspicuously patting themselves on the back for signing that promissory note in Paris, quietly edging towards default now that vulnerable nations and future generations are demanding payment here now in Glasgow.
The first draft text published Wednesday urges countries to revisit and strengthen their emissions cutting targets before the end of 2022. It says rich countries should go beyond the pledge to pay poorer nations $100 billion a year. And it calls on governments to phase out coal and fossil fuels, but with no fixed dates. Jennifer Morgan is the executive director of Greenpeace International.
Countries need to commit to actually come back to increase and strengthen their targets and their actions. That's clearly one thing. The text does include that coal will be phased out and fossil fuel subsidies will be phased out. I think optimally you would have dates by which time they would be phased out, but it's important that they're there.
With their joint declaration, observers say the United States and China have given added impetus to the summit. The coming hours will show whether the international community can agree on how to halt catastrophic global warming. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The declaration says the U.S. and China will also revive a working group that will meet regularly to address the climate crisis and advance the multilateral process focusing on enhancing concrete actions in this decade. Both Washington and Beijing intend to update the world on their new national targets for 2035 and 2025, a move that is particularly significant for China. The declaration also says China will make best efforts to accelerate its plan to reduce coal consumption in the second half of this decade. We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Chinese leaders issue official history to elevate Xi, extend rule. Afghanistan at brink of economic collapse, warns Pakistan. Protester sentenced to nearly 6 years for promoting Hong Kong's independence from China. Filipinos camp out to register to vote in next year's elections. Pacific Island nation warns COP26 officials about effects of climate change. Additional coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Former Australian Prime Minister Paul Keating has said Canberra's policy on China is misguided and fails to understand the country's rise. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports for VOA.
Paul Keating was Australian Prime Minister from 1991 to 1996. Throughout his career, he emphasized the need for Australia to foster closer ties with its neighbors in the Indo-Pacific. Addressing the National Press Club in Canberra Wednesday, he criticised Australia's current attitudes toward China, its biggest trading partner. Relations have been fraught over a range of geopolitical disputes, including the blocking of Chinese telecommunications company Huawei from Australia's 5G network, and allegations of Chinese interference in Australian politics. Canberra's call for an independent probe into the origins of COVID-19, which was first detected in China in late 2019, also infuriated Beijing. It's responded with various import restrictions on Australian goods, including coal and wine. Keating argued Australia could have a civil relationship with China, even though there may be disagreements. He stressed that Canberra shouldn't be drawn into a military engagement over Taiwan because it wasn't a vital Australian interest. He also criticised Australia's plans to build nuclear submarines under the new AUKUS alliance with the United States and the United Kingdom. He said the technology would be outdated by the time the vessels were in service.
8 submarines against China when we get the submarines in 20 years' time. It'll be like throwing a handful of toothpicks at a mountain.
Alan Gingell is a former senior advisor to Paul Keating and the former head of the Office of National Assessments, an Australian intelligence agency. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation the former Prime Minister has accurately summed up Australia's problems with China.
He's right that the relationship between Australia and China at the moment has never been worse since we established diplomatic relations. And I also think he's right in pointing to the lack of depth of understanding about China itself in the Australian debate.
The current Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison hasn't yet responded to Keating's remarks. However, a government lawmaker, James Patterson, reportedly said the former leader's assessments were out of date. Morrison has previously insisted that the AUKUS alliance was in Australia's national interests and would boost regional security. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, children between the ages of 5 and 11 are rolling up their sleeves to get their first COVID shot in the U.S. Happening now in Asia, In India, at least 14 people died Thursday in the state of Tamil Nadu due to heavy rainfall and strong winds, with many cities flooded by knee-deep water. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you decided to join us on VOA Asia. Children in America between the ages of 5 and 11 can now get their COVID-19 vaccinations. A lower dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has been approved for the youngest age group yet. VOA's Bigham Dunn Mizarsos has more from a vaccination center in Fairfax, Virginia.
Children in America can now get their first COVID-19 vaccines at centers like this one in Fairfax, Virginia. Earlier this month, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control approved a recommendation that children between 5 and 11 years old receive a pediatric dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Now, the first of some 28 million eligible children in America are taking their first dose.
It doesn't even hurt. I thought it was just over when, like, 5 minutes after. I felt a little bit of it, but it didn't hurt.
Pfizer-BioNTech says the vaccine is about 91% effective in this age group. Children aged 5 to 11 receive one-third of the dose provided to adults and other children over the age of 12. The dose amount is said to be powerful enough to trigger a strong immunological response while being low enough to avoid unwanted side effects. But some parents still aren't sure about following the recommendation. According to a 10-day study by the Kaiser Family Foundation in October, nearly one-third of parents with children between 5 and 11 said they plan to wait and see before having their children vaccinated.
I guess I would say do your research. I think it's safer to get the vaccine than not to, personally, but that's me. I don't want my kids getting COVID, so I feel good that we're on our way to being fully vaccinated.
Nearly 84% of Fairfax County residents have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. There is currently no data available for children between 5 to 11 years old. Bigham Dunn Mizarsos, VOA News, Fairfax, Virginia.
Be sure to read and see more on this story at VOA Asia Facebook. And in other U.S. COVID news, the governor of the state of Tennessee said Wednesday he plans to sign a wide-reaching bill strictly limiting what governments and companies can require to address the COVID-19 pandemic, despite opposition from prominent business interests. The Republican Governor Bill Lee told reporters, "There are some issues we need to work through with the legislation, but his signature will enact the changes as lawmakers pass them, putting them in effect immediately. Major restrictions would largely bar governments and businesses from requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccinations and only let public entities, including schools, require masks due to COVID-19 in rare, dire public health scenarios." The governor had not weighed in on the bill directly until Wednesday, using it to criticize U.S. President Joe Biden's requirement for workers at larger employers to get a COVID-19 vaccine by January 4th or face rigorous COVID-19 testing, which a federal appeals court has paused for now amid legal challenges. The state law will conflict with that requirement, sparking headaches for businesses that can face lawsuits under the law if someone feels slighted by a company's vaccination policy.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. The Australian medical tech manufacturer Allum has recalled more than 2 million at-home COVID-19 tests shipped to the United States after finding an increased chance of false positives. All the important stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Cybersecurity specialists say sales of fake vaccine cards in the U.S. have picked up dramatically after a federal vaccine mandate was issued. And more companies are now requesting proof of vaccination, which officials say is also having an impact. Lisa Bacaliotz has the story, narrated by VOA's Anna Rice.
Most vaccinated Americans prove they've been vaccinated by carrying a small piece of paper filled in by hand. It contains a person's full name, date of birth, type of the vaccine, number of doses, and the batch number. It was designed to inform, not protect against fraud, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
The card itself was meant to be a communication device between a provider and a patient that they were vaccinated, and even a reminder to show, if applicable, a second dose needed to be administered within a time period.
But this paper is still widely used as proof of vaccination in America today. As more companies request proof of vaccination, officials say more fake cards are being used.
We've seen it go from early in 2021 from maybe receiving 5 to 6 complaints per day to now we're receiving maybe 20 to 25 complaints per day through our hotline of fake vaccination card complaints.
Cybersecurity experts say sites offering fake vaccine cards have moved from mostly the dark net to more widely used sites on the internet.
It's pretty bad. They're using Facebook, Instagram, Telegram, and WhatsApp to market and promote these cards.
In certain online groups, fake vaccination cards are being offered quite openly, and happy clients even publish their pictures with fakes. Experts from the Coalition for a Safer Web even tried it themselves. Fraudsters respond quickly and guarantee delivery throughout the U.S. Experts at Checkpoint Software Technologies say sales picked up dramatically after a federal government vaccine mandate for federal workers.
The number of sellers of fake vaccine cards was increased by approximately tenfold. So we saw about 1,000 sellers in August. September after the announcement, it was spiking to 10,000.
Specialists at Checkpoint Software Technologies say one possible solution is to develop a unified federal vaccination database and digital cards that verify vaccination status, something some European countries are already doing. For Lisa Bacaliotz in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, Chinese shoppers spent $139.1 billion during this year's annual Singles Day online shopping festival, breaking last year's record, even though consumer spending slowed amid economic uncertainty during the coronavirus pandemic. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a U.S. public school teacher is the winner of a prestigious global teaching prize worth $1 million, the biggest such award for educators in the world. Keshia Thorpe received the Global Teacher Prize Wednesday at UNESCO's Paris headquarters. Thorpe teaches 12th grade English at the International High School in Langley Park, Maryland. She was awarded the honor from a field of more than 8,000 educators from 121 countries, many of whom work in impoverished and conflict-ravaged communities. Thorpe's students mostly come from immigrant and refugee families.
When you teach a diverse set of students like I do, you don't want to stick to very textbook methods because kids in the 21st century classroom are not engaged through textbook methods. We have to find innovative ways and creative ways to use technology, to use real life experiences, to bring the classroom out, to bring them out into the world so that they can field trips, so they can experience the world.
Thorpe is a native of Jamaica who came to the United States with her identical twin sister, Tricia, to attend college after winning track and field scholarships. She graduated from Howard University in 2003 as a pre-law and English student. She pledged to use the money to expand projects she has started to help disadvantaged students attend college without debt and to provide other services for immigrant children and families. The Global Teacher Prize has been awarded annually since 2015 by the London-based Varkey Foundation in partnership with UNESCO. The foundation is the philanthropic arm of GEMS Education, a company that owns and operates private K-12 schools in a handful of countries, including Egypt and the United Arab Emirates. And in space news, 4 astronauts are on their way to the International Space Station after a spectacular Wednesday night launch from the U.S. spaceport in Florida.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. And liftoff.
Americans Racha Chari, Kayla Barron, and Thomas Marshburn, and Germany's Matthias Maurer blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center aboard a SpaceX Crew Dragon to begin a six-month stay aboard the ISS. They are expected to rendezvous and dock with the ISS Thursday night. The quartet's initial Halloween launch date was delayed due to weather concerns and an undisclosed illness of one of the crew members. Based on his mission assignment, Maurer officially became the 600th person to fly into space since human spaceflight began 60 years ago. This is the third official operational crew and the fourth overall to fly to the ISS aboard a SpaceX Crew Dragon since last May, when the U.S. space agency NASA first resumed launching astronauts from American soil since 2011, when the space shuttle program ended. A two-man crew was first launched by SpaceX to the orbital outpost to demonstrate Crew Dragon's capabilities. Four people orbited the Earth aboard a SpaceX Crew Dragon for 3 days in September to become the world's first all-civilian spaceflight. And in other news, a fatal shooting during the U.S. production of a movie called Rust is raising questions about safety on movie sets. Authorities are still investigating the October 21st shooting south of Santa Fe, Mexico. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Tom Forrest, director of the film program at Central New Mexico Community College, about safety measures on production sets.
Santa Fe Fire and EMS, what's the location of emergency?
Bonanza Creek Ranch has had two people accidentally shot on a movie set by a prop gun. We need help immediately. Okay. Bonanza Creek Ranch, come on.
Stay on the phone with me. We're going to get some help, okay?
The Rust movie set shooting in New Mexico took the life of cinematographer Halina Hutchins and wounded film director Joel Souza. Lead actor and film producer Alec Baldwin fired a prop gun in the direction of the camera where Hutchins and Souza were positioned. Before handing the weapon, Assistant Director Dave Halls reportedly announced the gun, an antique Colt 45, was a cold gun, meaning it did not have any live rounds. Tim Forrest, director of the film program at Central New Mexico Community College, says there are safety measures in place during production.
Every shoot that I've ever been on, there are protocols. There are strict protocols for safety, for stunts. But what happens in filmmaking, and this is across the board, is that when you have one more hour of light, you know, before you have to wrap, things get manic. The more you can squeeze out of a particular production, the more profit you can make potentially. So these people are really talented, but they're also really overworked.
According to the Los Angeles Times and Deadline Hollywood, camera operators walked off the Rust set due to lack of payment and poor safety conditions. Lane Looper headed the camera department on Rust.
You know, I've never felt I was more in danger of dying on the set or on the drive home, because I was exhausted.
Authorities spoke with reporters about the scene after the shooting.
There was a total of 500 rounds of ammunition. That is a mix of blanks, dummy rounds, and what we are suspecting, live rounds.
Armorer Gutierrez Reed told investigators that live ammunition was never kept on set. Forrest says there are strict rules on how to handle a gun on set.
People make that announcement. This is a cold gun. The first AD will open up the barrel, spin it, show it to whomever. Does anyone want to see this? You know, does anyone have any questions about this? You know, does everyone see that there are no rounds in this weapon? You know, does anyone not see? Does anybody want to see closer? And of course, inevitably, there will be somebody that wants to see, because it is anxiety ridden, you know, to have a live weapon on set.
Investigators are looking into how a live round made it into the Colt 45 prop gun. Forrest says gun safety measures have been since the early days of Hollywood, including placing bulletproof glass between the camera and the gun.
It's classic, you know, from the great train robbery. The last shot is the guy pointing right at the camera.
Still, there have been other on-set accidents, like when Brandon Lee was shot during production of the 1994 film The Crow. Since the Rust shooting, actor Dwayne Johnson has said his production company will no longer use real guns.
We are going to be using rubber guns, and we'll take care of it in post. And we won't worry about the dollars, we won't worry about math or what the cost is. I think we're going to do it the right way, and that's what we're going to do at $7.
Johnson is one of many actors and producers who are now calling for the removal of all real guns from movie sets. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can also find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Keith Lane, Chris Cascao, Jessica Stone, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. Now go and make it a great day.